I am pleased to be able to present to you for this year one of the speakers. Again, you guys know Boaz Michael. Just want to mention that, you know, Boaz is the founder and director of First Fruits of Zion, one of the ministries, probably the leading ministry in the Messianic movement as far as being able to produce materials and resources for us to use. There are a number of ministries in the Hebraic Messianic movement, but very few of them produce things that we can do anything with other than just listen to. But Boaz has resources, the Highest Ode program that is a step-by-step process in helping to understand Torah and the Hebraic walk. And so they've got a lot to offer, and we really appreciate it. We've known Boaz and their family and been associated to some degree with First Fruits of Zion for about 12 years now, and we're just really thankful for them. So to give the message this morning, will be Boaz Michael.
Shalom. Good morning. Very nice to be here once again at Seasons of Our Joy. Thank you, Tim and Angie, for all the work that you do to host this and plan for this and prepare for this throughout the year. I appreciate it as a... Our family certainly has benefited from participating in this, and I know that many others have as well. And I also want to say a special thanks to the coffee crew in the back. The coffee this year has been above par, and they've done a great job. This morning, I would like to build on... Can we go ahead and move to my PowerPoint? I'd like to build on what Dean spoke of yesterday. I was very grateful for his message. And I felt that it was a necessary message because he's addressing real problems within our movement. And I sensed that many of you resonated with his message, and I wanted to build on that and to continue to discuss that with you this morning. At the end of his talk yesterday, he said that this was more of an internal talk, that it was more for a correction within our movement. And a gentleman asked the question at the end and said, well, how do we begin to reach out and repair and restore relationships with those outside of our movement, the church, brothers and sisters, family members? And I wanted to kind of do a part two of repairing the breach and talk about repairing relationships with those outside of this movement. Because certainly, the way that we judge each other in this movement is a result of the way that we've judged others outside of this movement. And I'd like to build some foundations, some filters this morning for you to consider that should help all of us in how we see others, other people of God, other brothers and sisters in the Messiah, that can help us begin to fundamentally trust that they want to know Jesus better. Now, let's see here. There we go. Know Jesus better. This is a theme that we have at First Fruits, is that we want the people of God to know Jesus better because we fundamentally believe that every Christian wants to know Jesus better. And in order for Christians to know Jesus better, in our opinion, they need to know Him in His Jewishness. But how are we going to communicate that message? And how are we going to restore the relationships that have been broken between this movement and the wider church, between you and brothers and sisters in the Messiah? We need to develop some new filters to see our brothers and sisters through. So I threw this message together yesterday quickly, based upon what Dean had said and based upon wanting to build upon what he had said. My original talk was going to be on Romans 1:16, speaking of the gospel message to the Jewish people first and then to the nations. It was going to be an exhortation for us to begin to consider within our Messianic movement the responsibility that we have to share the Jewish Messiah with the Jewish people. But quite frankly, until we get our internal problems fixed, until we adjust our attitudes, our haughtiness, we really shouldn't be taking that message of the Messiah to the Jewish people. We have a lot We have a lot to do. We have a lot to change. We have a lot of maturing to do, and we have a lot of growth that we need to incur. So this morning's message is going to be a bit unscripted. It won't be so measured, so to speak. At times, perhaps it might come to you as a challenge, but I want you to hear my heart this morning. I want you to hear my heart of correction for all of us, each and every one of us, so that we can truly begin to make a change, make an impact, and restore broken relationships, or as Dean would say, repair the breach. So let's open up with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump into today's message. Our Father in heaven, You have given us so much. You have opened our eyes to the wonderful things of Your Torah. Father, You have bestowed upon us truths of Your Word that have been hidden to others. And Father, some of us, at times, all of us, have taken those truths that You have graciously given to us, and we've allowed them to puff us up. Our knowledge puffed us up, Father, and we repent. And Father, our arrogance and our pride and our knowledge brought separation between us and our brothers and sisters. And we allowed that to blind our eyes and to obscure like our wisdom and how to handle relationships, how to love others. So Father, first and foremost for myself, I come before You and I repent for that arrogance. I repent for that haughtiness. And I ask that You give me another chance to reach all of Your people with the precious truth that You've given me. Father, I ask as we go through this teaching this morning that You convict and that You bring to mind situations that we need to repent from and restore and humble ourselves. And I ask that You give us those opportunities once again. I pray this in the name of the Messiah, Yeshua. Amen and amen. This week begins a new cycle in the Torah reading schedule. So this coming Shabbat, the scrolls will be unrolled or rolled back, and we will be reading from Bereshit or Bereshit once again this week, starting in Genesis chapter 1. We see in the narrative, "And God said," over and over, as the act of creation is unfolding, God says, "Let there be light," and there was light. And He says, "Let the earth sprout vegetation," and vegetation comes forth. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night." And God said and spoke directly without consultation. He said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly." God spoke, and it was created. But then we come to the narrative in the act of creation, and it changes. Rather than God speaking directly without consultation, the language of the narrative changes, and it says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image." So rather than God just speaking directly and saying, you know, "Let there be light. Let vegetation sprout forth." He steps back and it begins this conversation that is kind of strange in the narrative because we don't know exactly what it means. It's intriguing. But man was created through the course of conversation. Man was created through the course of conversation. Thus, life is created out of dialogue and conversation. Life, man, is created out of dialogue and conversation. Going forward in the narrative of Genesis, still within Bereshit. You're going to read this week. We see another section that says, Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Look at the text carefully. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, period. Stop. The rabbis have looked at this and questioned, like, that's kind of strange. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, but it doesn't say what was said. It doesn't allude to what was discussed. In fact, the rabbis say nothing was discussed. They say that this is an example of Cain just speaking to his brother, meaning there's no conversation here. There's no dialogue. It's Cain speaking directly, making a statement. And then we see that they were in the field. Cain rose up and killed his brother Abel. Thus we can say that death comes when there is no dialogue and conversation. So do you see what's happening in the narrative of Bereshit? That through dialogue and conversation, life was created. But when we see the story of Cain and Abel, when there's direct statements made, and there is no conversation, death occurs. So this morning, I want to have an honest conversation with you, and I want to have an honest dialogue with you, and I ask that you give me patience as I work this through. Because one of the things that I'm going to be challenging you with is to learn to have conversation and dialogue with those that you do not agree with. Because in conversation and dialogue, there is life. In statements, in judgments, there's death. So here's the first thing I want you to consider, and I want you to think about, that the church is good. That the church is fundamentally good. I'll expand that to say that Christianity is not pagan. Christians are not something apart from us, different or distinct from us. Christians are our brothers and sisters in Messiah. Here's a challenging one that you need to consider. But again, let us dialogue and let us converse. There is nothing wrong with Sunday worship. The church is valid. And not only is the church valid, it's needed as part of God's universal plan within this earth. These have to become foundations that create a proper and legitimate and honest foundation for discussion and dialogue to take place. If you cannot work past these ideas and begin to consider something a bit broader, everything that you say and everything you do will feel somewhat disingenuous. And even though you may not be speaking words of judgment, there will be a sense of judgment coming across through the words in which you're speaking. Let me share with you some good things that the church does. I want to remind you of some things. This first point, community impact and engagement. You know, there's a church in Katy, Texas. It's a church that First Fruits of Zion is working with. They are implementing our programs into their various adult study programs and Sunday school programs. And this church is a very large church. It's about 6,000 members. They have 16 full-time pastors. It's a beautiful church. It's very functional within the community. Every quarter, they shut services down on Sunday. They actually have a staff member who's paid full-time to coordinate 4 community outreach sessions each year. Because on Sunday, when they shut down each quarter, they'll take 7,000 people, their members, and they'll go and they'll transform an entire section of their city. Building parks, doing community service, transforming apartment complexes, upgrading people's homes. There's no offering taken that day. In fact, people are giving of their own monies and their own time to transform their community. A few months ago, I had an unfortunate call. I was visiting a particular city, and the individuals found out that I was there, and they called and said that they have a friend who is dying of cancer, and they asked if I would come pray for him. So, of course, I took the time to go pray for this man, and I go visit him, and he's in this specialized clinic. He's outside of his city. And I go and visit him, and I learn this story that impacted me and was a very beautiful expression of impact and engagement. So here's a gentleman who lived in Colorado, but went to a specialized cancer treatment center in Texas. And he went there for treatment, and while he's there for treatment, his family members are coming because he's dying, and they're wanting to say they love him, and they want to connect with him, and they want to, you know, encourage him and love him, and all the things that happen during times of people's pain and hardship and passing. But this process is going on and on and on, and he's not passing away. So his family members could no longer afford to come visit him because they couldn't afford hotels. They couldn't afford places to stay. They were out of money. So come to find out, 11 churches formed a collective, and they bought an entire apartment complex. And on the campus of this cancer treatment center, they have this apartment complex where they allow for families to come and stay for free to visit family members that are in the process of dying, because it's hard to pay for hotels and all that stuff during that process. There was no expectations. Those churches just simply did this as a form of caring for those that are in the stages of loss. Recently, I was in L.A., and I spoke at a meeting there that was attended by dozens and dozens of workers that are serving in a ministry at the L.A. area called the Dream Center. And I'm not sure if you've ever heard of the Dream Center, but I was impacted by its testimony. They feed 40,000 people each week. Not only do they feed 40,000 meals each week, but they have hostels for people that are in need and transition, that lose their jobs, that don't have money, to come and stay for free. Not only that, but they have housing for women, and they make one-year commitments to these ladies that have been beaten and battered by their husbands to come and stay within this treatment center to be able to reestablish their lives. That's just brief examples of things that the church does that are good and needed. Community healing and restoration. A few weeks ago, I visited a church, and when I visited this church, I get out of my car in the parking lot, and they have rock and roll blasting through loudspeakers. In fact, the music that was playing was this modern-day rapper. Her name is Pink. She happens to be Jewish. And you walk into this church, and there's 1,000 different things going on, and there's TVs and flat screens and football on this TV and CNN on this TV, and they have all this crazy stuff happening at this church. You go into the main auditorium and it's like a rock and roll concert. Big screens, you know, smoke coming off the top. It would be easy for us to sit back and to judge that church and say, well, that's just like seeker friendly. They're not really teaching truth. It's just a bunch of entertainment. All of those things, and perhaps that's true, but you know what the pastor says? He says, everyone that's coming to this church anyway is already listening to rock and roll. They're already listening to Pink. They're already watching football on Sunday or on Saturday. And I want to make the hurdle for people coming into the kingdom as low as possible so that they'll come here and that they can hear a message of salvation. Now again, we may want to sit back and judge that. But do you know that I've met people that came in through that church that are now just as devoted to the kingdom of God as you are? That church was the connecting place in which their journey started. And now they're serving God and growing in the ways of God. Growing in the grace and knowledge of Messiah. Community healing and restoration. I can't tell you how many churches that I speak in where every one of those churches have AA programs, where they have addiction recovery programs within their churches throughout the weeks. Those are the very real needs of the world that we live in. This is a broken world. How about the Catholic Church? The Catholic Church itself has been the leading voice against abortion in this world. But yet we're so quick to judge and condemn the Catholic Church for its various reasons. But yet can't we look and see some good? We need to be able to judge in righteousness. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 15, we have this phrase that says, "But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor." The rabbis work through this text and basically say that this text means that you need to learn to see the good in everyone. Learn to see the good in everyone. Can you do that? Can I do that? Can we go into situations in which there's problems, but yet can we seek to see the good and then affirm the good? You see, affirmation builds bridges. So when you go into a situation and there may be a lot of bad things taking place, if you can find that one good thing and affirm it and build a bridge, a connecting point, then through the context of relationship and affirmation, you have the opportunity to potentially, at times, or over time, bring change and correction. So I have entitled my lecture this morning, Judging in Righteousness. And I want to help you learn, and I'm speaking to myself as well, to judge favorably. Recently, a friend of mine, whose family is a Messianic family that has gone to a church that is in the process of making integration or change in the area of Torah, festivals, all those things. So this is a 2,000-member church. First Fruits of Zion has our High Esod programs in there. This church uses our Torah Club programs. And there was a Messianic family that was isolated, alone, in their living room every Sabbath. And I said, look, here's a great opportunity for your family to go be a point of light to this church that's going through this process of change. So I encouraged the family to go into this church to help, to facilitate, to educate. So I stay in touch with this individual. This is actually happening in quite a few places. And a few months ago, he popped me on Facebook, you know, that little like thing that pops up that someone's chatting with you. And he says, hey, how you doing? I write back, how are you doing? How are things at the church? And he writes me back and he says, you can really tell the difference between those that are seeking truth and not seeking truth. He's not judging favorably. He's not looking for the good in everyone. And I wrote him back immediately and said, wait a minute. Consider your statement. You're telling me that you can really tell those that are seeking truth and those that are not. How do you know? I mean, to me, if a person comes to church on Sunday morning, that on some level they're seeking truth, why would they take the time? Why would they make the effort if they weren't seeking some form of truth? We live in a very, very broken world, a hurting world, lives that are destroyed through sin. And how do you know that a person that's coming to church on Sunday morning isn't just overwhelmed with life to the point that they can't even think beyond the fact that God loves them and they're hurting and they need friendship and affirmation? So maybe that person only can absorb the idea that God's grace is afforded or offered to them. So we need to begin to see things differently so that we can see and judge people favorably. I want to go through six aspects of dialogue and conversation with you this morning. I want to talk about speaking words of peace and shalom. I want to talk about not judging others and what that looks like. I want to talk about no name calling, loving others, trust God, trusting God and giving honor to others, seeking the good, seeing the good, finding the good. So let's start this morning with speaking words of shalom. Dean yesterday opened up with this text from Psalm 33, behold how good and how pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. And he began to build his lecture as an internal rebuke and correction, saying, if we don't change and seek to be unified with one another, this movement is in jeopardy of being destroyed. And he's certainly correct. You may not experience it or see it, but certainly people like Dean and myself and others see it because we experience the movement. We see the movement. We see the fractured communities and homes and lives. And our movement certainly is in jeopardy of being destroyed. And we do need to seek unity. And unity is sought first and foremost by seeking shalom and peace. The rabbis pick up on this, and they say in Perkei Avot, Hillel said, be the disciples of Aaron, loving peace and pursuing peace, loving your neighbor and bringing them closer to Torah. So here we have this formula. And I want you to see this formula because you're going to see it again in a second in the apostles, in the apostolic literature, where if we want to bring people closer to Torah, the agent or the vehicle to do that is love and peace. Loving your neighbor, pursuing peace, and bringing them closer to the Torah. James reflects on this. Look what James says. James says, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits. It's impartial and it's insincere. It's sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. If you want to see a harvest of righteousness, if you want to see people embrace the Torah, if you want to see people embrace a Hebraic understanding of their faith, those seeds are sown by being an individual that is a peaceful person, that makes peace, that seeks peace, that speaks words gentle words, being open to reason, being full of mercy and good fruits. Do you see that? You see that the way in which we experience a harvest of righteousness, that we teach others the Torah, is through planting seeds of peace and watering those with love and devotion. The Master says in Matthew chapter 5, He says, "Oh, the gladness of those who pursue shalom, for they will be called the sons of God." This isn't passive. This is active. "Oh, the gladness of those who pursue shalom, for they will be called sons of God." This "oh, the gladness" phrase, the Hebrew behind that phrase, is the Hebrew word ashrei. Ashrei is an impossible word to translate properly into English. Most translators translate ashrei as blessed. Some translators translate it as praiseworthy. Others translate it as fortunate. Ashrei has a sense of now, but also primarily in the future. And the idea behind ashrei is that in the temporary time period, like now, we experience some uncomfort, but in the future is our full reward. So in pursuing peace with others, at this time, in this moment, we experience a little bit of uncomfort. It's hard. It's difficult. But the future reward of pursuing peace is that we will be called sons of God. So this is to say that no matter how difficult it is and how challenging it is, learn to pursue peace. Be peaceable. Be reasonable. And be the sons of God. Matthew 5 closes with the statement, "Therefore, be peaceable, just as your Father who is in heaven is peaceable." Folks, we need to have patience and trust, and trust in the sovereignty of God. Do you know God is very slow? He's like a freight train, a slow-moving freight train. If God is slow in fulfilling His promises, then why can't we also take on that characteristic of God and be slow in our expectations of others? Have trust in God. Trust that He's working in others' lives. If we hope to make an impact in others' lives, it will only be done through the spirit of peace and shalom, honest and open dialogue, transparency. I want to talk to you this morning a bit about not judging. We tend to have an exalted view of ourselves. But in reality, judging others only reveals our own insecurities. Judging others only reveals our own flaws. Judging others only reveals our own sins. That is to say, when you point the fingers at others and you judge them for this or you condemn them for that, that is what you yourself are engaged in. James tells us, "Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against his brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, He who is able to save and destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor?" Look at this text. "Do not speak evil against one another. The one who speaks against his brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Consider this. That is to say that if we point fingers at other people and say, well, they're not keeping the Torah, they're not doing this, they're not eating kosher, they're not keeping the Sabbath, that in that act of judgment, we're judging the law and the lawgiver, and we're being told that we ourselves are not doing the very same law that we're judging others for not keeping. So that says when you judge someone for not keeping the Sabbath, that you yourself are a Sabbath breaker and violator and a lawbreaker. The Master says, do not judge so that you will not be judged. For with the judgment that you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure that you use to measure, it will be measured to you. When we judge people and when we out of hand condemn the church for its various violations, or we look at individuals and family members and friends and judge them for not keeping the Torah the way that we think they should be keeping the Torah, and we judge them for violating the Sabbath, what's the Master say? The way you judge them and say that they've broken the Sabbath is the same way that you will be judged for breaking the Sabbath. Yesterday, Dean, he was going to that Proverbs text, and at the end of each line, he kept saying, we need to check ourselves. We need to check ourselves. And every time he said that, this kind of modern and hip phrase kept coming to my mind. And it was this phrase, we need to check ourselves before you wreck yourself. Meaning we need to check ourselves first and foremost before we end up a wreck for our judgment of others. What does change look like? What do we expect? When we sit back and say, someone should be keeping the Sabbath, or this family member, or this church, what is our expectation? Is our expectation that they should keep the Sabbath like us? Like me? Is that proper Sabbath observance? Is that keeping the Sabbath? We need to learn to appreciate small steps and expect small steps. For example, as we counsel pastors about integrating and bringing in our programs into their churches, we encourage small steps because we know that through small steps, true change is sustainable. So a pastor will get all excited and he'll say, I want to incorporate this and I want to incorporate this and I want to do Hayasod for all of our church. I want to take the whole church through Hayasod. And every time, we'll pull him back and say, hold on one second, we need to slow down a little bit. Why don't you and your elders go through Hayasod? And then you learn the material and you learn how to properly articulate that to your community, to your flock, as a good shepherd. Now, I could get really excited and say, yeah, take all 15,000 or 10,000 or 5,000 of your members through the Hayasod program. But I know that if he did that, the change that I desire to see within that church would not take place. So we need to learn to appreciate small steps. Here's a small step for you. A pastor begins to reconcile the understanding of the Sabbath in his own mind. And he sits back and says, how can I begin to incorporate this into my church body who's been keeping Sunday for the past 50 years? Is a small step that we can appreciate, that we can encourage that pastor to never again say from the pulpit that Sunday has replaced Saturday as the Shabbat, or that the Shabbat has been done away with by the work of Christ? If he just simply changes his dialogue and doesn't say those things from an authoritative position, is that a change? Is that a step? Is that something that should be affirmed and encouraged? We need to learn to appreciate small steps. And help people understand the process of effective change. I want to talk about no name calling for a few minutes. Because a small percentage of people in this movement affect our ability to get into the church and bring change to the church. When we refer to the church as pagan, when we make fun of Christians, calling them names, disingenuous, or whatever we may do, those words go into that church and they paint us all as intolerant and judgmental. And then as a result of ministries like ours trying to go into that church to bring change and affected real change, the pastors sit back and say, well, I want nothing to do with that movement because it's full of a bunch of judgmental and petty-minded people. And I want to use the words of the Master to bring correction in this area. The Master said, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I tell you, or I say to you, that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. And I want to emphasize these last few sections. And hopefully the words of the Master will prick us and change us and convict us. Because the Master says, if you say, you fool, if you call someone recha, that's the Hebrew behind that word, recha, someone that is not worthy, someone that's a fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So here we are, like mocking and making fun of people, making fun of the church, judging them, calling them names. Because they're not living up to the standards in which we expect for them to live up to. But yet we ourselves are violating the words of the Master, and we ourselves are now liable to the fires of hell based upon our casting judgment and speaking wrong and speaking names. We need to basically learn to keep our mouths shut. We should have learned this in grade school. Name-calling is petty, bad, and wrong, and unproductive. It makes us look like a fool. The truth that we've been given, the truth of the Torah and the truth of Messiah, they are far too precious of truth to be established upon the disparagement of others. Why do I need to, like, convince someone of the beautiful cycle of the festivals by speaking about the paganism of this Christian festival? Why do I need to speak about the beauty of Sukkot, you know, by tearing down something else? Isn't what I have to offer so beautiful and so precious that it can be established on its own merit? Rather than on the dismantling of other truth, the truth that we've been given is far too precious to be established by disparaging others. We're criticized on every angle, oftentimes at First Fruit Design. We're criticized because people say that we love the rabbis, that we just submit wholeheartedly to the rabbis. That we, like carte blanche, take everything and just kind of like, well, I guess that's what it means. Because we use the wisdom of the sages and we use rabbinic literature from time to time in our teachings. Some people think that First Fruits of Zion is, you know, not not bold and not passion because we're not out there like tearing down the church and like burning the church building, so to speak. And the perception comes because we do not speak ill of Judaism and we do not speak ill of the church. See, we try to establish our truth and what we know based upon the merit of itself, not by disparaging the rabbis and saying the rabbis are all wrong and bad, just following traditions of men. And the church is all bad and wrong and full of paganism and idolatry. Why do we need to say that? It's unhealthy and it's unproductive and it shuts down dialogue. We need to learn to love others. This text from 1 Corinthians, I believe Dean read this yesterday. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but it rejoices with truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I opened up this lecture with that phrase from Deuteronomy, judging in righteousness. Judging in righteousness tells us that we are to seek the good and see the good in every situation. And this closing statement of this text where it says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things, I think is the way in which we can judge in righteousness. Thinking the best, hoping the best, waiting for the best in everyone and every person. Think about your own family for a second, you fathers out there. Think about how difficult it's been for you to incorporate Torah into your home as a father and then pass that to your wife and then also take that same Torah and pass that to your children. Think about how difficult that has been and how challenging that's been. Now put yourself in the position of a pastor, of a member of a church of 1,500 who in many ways is serving as that father figure of that community. And have like love and patience towards him because he's sitting there saying, I want to bring change to my church. But how do I do this righteously and graciously? So as difficult as it's been for you to bring Torah into your life with five people, imagine how difficult it is for 1,500 people. And perhaps if we could put ourselves in his shoes, we can be a little bit more respectful towards him. Maybe come alongside him and help him. You know how many churches are out there waiting for you to go be a part of it? How many churches are there waiting for you to come and be a productive member, a productive point of communication and connection and restoration back to its foundation? Hundreds. Hundreds. But you don't see them. We don't see them because we're isolated in our places of self-righteousness, in our home groups, saying, we're the only people that are right. The church is wrong. Judaism is wrong. And the only people who are right there are the six people sitting in this living room. They're waiting. It's there. There are good churches waiting for good people to come in and make an impact in that church. We can sit back and judge all day long, but until we attempt to do something about it, we have really no merit in what we say in that regard. We're told to be imitators of God and walk in love as the Messiah loved us and gave himself up for us. So when I encourage, when I say there's churches waiting, that might require some sacrifice on your part. It might require some challenge on your part. But give yourself up. Give yourself up just as the Messiah gave himself up in love towards your brothers and sisters and go and connect and be respectful and get opportunity to transform the church with us. Love is the centerpiece of the Torah. The absolute centerpiece. This year, my colleague and I, Toby Janicki, are going through the Torah for our Torah Club program, Torah Club Volume 1, and we're drashing or midrashing every parsha, every Torah portion, in the area in which that Torah portion highlights the centerpiece or the essential love within that parsha. And I can tell you, as we've done our work and prepared our lectures, it's absolutely phenomenal to see how love truly is the very centerpiece of the entire Torah, and every commandment boils back down to that essential truth. We need to learn to trust God. I'd like to look at Matthew chapter 25, verse 14 through 15. Actually, it's larger than this, but I'm not going to take the time to read the whole text. It says, it's a parable of the master. It says, "For it'll be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them to his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to the other 2, and to the other 1. Each according to his ability, then he went away." So you know the parable, right? Master's leaving on a long journey. He gives someone 5 talents, one servant. Another servant he gives 2 talents. And another servant he gives 1 talent. He's gone. He leaves. Immediately, the text says, the one that was given 5, without hesitation, went out and invested those talents and increased them, doubled them. It says the servant that was given 2 also doubled them, increased them. And the servant that was given 1 did nothing. He was afraid. He buried it and did not increase it. Now, a lot of commentators have talked about this idea of talents and what are talents. Talents are responsibilities. Talents are responsibilities that we've been given. And certainly, as we've been awakened to the reality of the Torah, each of us have been given different responsibilities, so to speak, within that as it's become revealed to us. So the story goes on, and basically the master returns, and he says, "Okay, servants, come to me. You know, what'd you do with my money? What'd you do with what I gave you?" And the one that was given 5 gave him back 10. The one that was given 2 gave him back 4. And the one that he gave him back 1. And he rebuked the one that had only received 1 and did nothing with it. And to the 2 that had increased what they were given, he said, "Well done, good and faithful servants. Enter into my kingdom." I use this parable to talk about the reality that different people have been given different responsibilities. And I'm using this to help create a filter for you to be able to trust that other people that aren't walking out their faith in the same way that you're walking out your faith may be doing 100% of what God expects of them. Can you consider that for a second? That just because people are doing different things doesn't mean that they're any less in God's eyes. Because maybe they're being 100% faithful with what they've been given. And in order to properly engage and converse and sincerely connect, we have to be able to trust that people are being faithful, as faithful as we are, so that when God looks down upon me and looks down upon this person, He looks at us both and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Some very, very godly, wonderful people may never get the reality of the Sabbath and may never keep the Sabbath the way you get the you keep the Sabbath. But that may be perfectly okay. Because maybe they weren't revealed that or given that as a responsibility. Maybe they were given something else. I think it's wise that we primarily be concerned with our own talents. Maybe those of us that have had the Sabbath revealed to us, maybe we should be more concerned about our own Sabbath observance than what people are or are not doing on the Sabbath. You're not going to be judged or held accountable for what they're doing. You're going to be judged and held accountable for what you are doing or not doing. Folks, I hope we get this, but I'm concerned that we don't. You know, I have a teaching principle that says, repeat, repeat, repeat again, and then explain your repetition. Because people don't get it. I mean, how many times have we been told not to park on the grass? But we still park on the grass. How many times have we been told to love others the way that we want to be loved? How many times have we been told to respect others? How many times have we sat back and said we trust in the sovereignty of God, but yet we really don't? Because when we look at others, we judge them for what God, or we perceive God is doing or not doing in their life. Let's give honor to one another. This is really a foundation stone that's critical. Paul tells us in Romans, he says, let love be genuine. Genuine love. Real love. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in the Spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be consistent in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. And seek to show hospitality. This verse forms somewhat of a mezuzah on our door in our Beit Midrash back at First Design. We have a study hall at our office. And it's a study hall where people go in and debate and discuss. And this verse is a plaque right on the front door, and we highlight this one phrase, outdo one another in showing honor. See, we tend to try to outdo one another in showing each other how halakhically observant we are to typically Torah commandments, or how observant I am to this. And we strive to outdo one another in a particular understanding of a text. But perhaps we should outdo one another in showing honor. What would our world look like if this truly was our centerpiece of thought? What would our lives look like? What would our movement look like if this is the way that we governed our lives? I need to close. But perhaps we should all strive to know Jesus better rather than striving to know the Torah better. Maybe we should study His words and allow His life to truly transform us. And maybe we should start there. Not setting Torah aside, but understand that right now we're not even reflecting the very one that we say that we follow. Thank you for your time. I apologize. I don't know how much time we have or don't have. But there are some questions. There's a question over here and there's one up here.
Thank you very much for your talk. I appreciate it. And I don't disagree with you. However, I, like many of my other tzitzit wearing Torah fields, would like to have you address the words of Jesus, and that has been presented in many other things in Revelation 18, which says, "Come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins and not partakers of her plagues." How that concept fits in what you just said. Thank you.
I'm having trouble hearing. Don't repeat it, because I think I heard it. And you're asking the question about the phrase, "Come out of her, my people." Is that right?
Revelation 18:4, where it says, "Come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sin, and be not partakers of her plagues." How that fits into what you missed is, I said, I agree with you. I appreciate what you've just said.
Okay.
And on behalf of other tzitzit-wearing Torah fills, I'd like you to address that in the context of what you just said.
Okay. I'll try. I think a foundation that maybe perhaps we don't share is that the church itself is the Babylonian system, and I don't have that as a perspective. I think that people should be far more concerned about Babylon in the television programs they watch, in the activities they participate in this worldly system, than pointing the finger to the church and saying the church is Babylon. Look, and Tim has a question up here. Okay, 5 minutes. Okay, other questions? There's one over here. And I'll address, there are good churches and there are bad churches. There are good pastors and there are bad pastors. When I encourage connection with the church, it's going to take time to find that right church and that good church, but they're out there. Next question. Up here in the front.
Thank you, sir, for your time, your message. I think the body of Yeshua is really needful for all of these wonderful messages we've heard. My question is that I am living in a city where I felt impressed to go and attend a Jewish temple. They are not messianic. I was impressed with the thought, I believe from the Father, that I am there to love them and to pray for their salvation. So whenever I go there, I tend to pray that for them. I take Yeshua in with me, but I don't speak of it. I would like your opinion as to how best to fellowship among them, and I've done this for several years. I've not approached Yeshua to any of them yet. What would you suggest?
I think you need to be honest with your faith and ask the rabbi if he'll allow you to participate within one of their study programs during the week. So thank you for your question.
Okay. Thank you.
Last question up here.
My question, I think it can kind of answer some of the other things that were mentioned here with the Babylonian system. My question is, does this apply personally to individuals as well to like corporations, a corporate church? And would you advocate officially joining an actual corporate church, a corporation?
If you're asking to join a denomination or something like that versus just going to a local church? He's asking about joining a corporation. I don't know much about that. I don't know how that functions in terms of if you sign something, you're actually signing up for a corporation or not. I will say that there are various levels of participation. You may not need to sign anything, or maybe you elect not to sign something. I mean, the point is to go and to be a point of connection and be respectful, and to use that as an opportunity to impart what the Father's given you. All right. Thank you very much. God bless you. Shalom.